discussion. Why would we find it hard to receive a gift? Why is that difficult?
It may be that...
If it's something for you, but don't speculate for other people. Or have you heard about it from other people?
No, it's about me.
Okay, good. So why would you find it difficult to receive it? Who would give you a gift and you would find it difficult to receive from?
A friend, for
example.
Why
would you find it difficult?
Because, you know, sometimes I feel I don't deserve it, or maybe she would need it more than I do if it's something that she's giving me. Or it may go to someone else who's more deserving than I am,
well,
or more
needy. It's ridiculous,
isn't
it? So what's the problem there? It's absurd.
It's attachment.
Like ridiculous. It's like fear. Underneath all that is almost like a fear that you might get criticized. Really, it's attachment. I think attachment to reputation, attachment to how we're seen by others is underpinning most of this. You know, like, oh my gosh, they're giving me a gift. I don't deserve it. Someone might look and see I don't deserve it, and how dare I? So we want to kind of cover ourselves, you know. It's very interesting. It's absurd. It's utterly absurd.
It is.
And if you understand the bodhisattva vows, it's of course you receive a gift. You give the person has the opportunity to create merit. How marvelous of you. Normally what happens also, you know, someone gives you a gift but you don't like it. Oh, thank you. You understand? But who cares if we like it? That's not even relevant either. Or even more simple, even something as simple as this. If, say, I'm at dinner with Lara and she offers me the bread and I say, no, thank you, I'm gluten-free. Now, we never think that's selfish, but that's just typical self-centeredness. I should say, thank you, what lovely piece of bread. No one's forcing me to eat it. I leave it on my plate, but I accept her gift. So people give us gift, accept it, be happy for them. And then if you want to give it away to someone else, that's your business. So it's just fear of what I think it's really attachment to what people think, right underneath. It really makes us nervous, you know. Do you understand? It's very interesting.
I do, thank you.
What else, people? Anyone else? Yeah, Max?
Yeah, so with regard to the dream practice that you were suggesting we do, no?
Yeah.
I monitored a little development in dreams over the course of the last couple of days.
You mean you saw you were dreaming when you dreamed, or you thought about your dreams when you woke up? Which one?
I was able to morally kind of like counteract negative situations in my dream.
So you were aware that you were dreaming?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Well done.
Okay.
So the point of that is we can see that when we're dreaming, we don't know we're dreaming, do we? And we take it all seriously, don't we? We have this vision, we have a thing, and then, and we get excited, we get upset, and then you wake up and you go, oh, just a dream. Mm-hmm. We get that. So the point is, that analogy is for life. The Lama say, because we have ego grasping, we grasp at everything in life as real. So it's very strange for us because, of course, we think it's real and we think the dream isn't real. But the whole Buddhist approach is the more we understand emptiness, the more we understand dependent arising, things will happen, but we won't be so grasping at it. We won't be so up and down like a yo-yo. It's life is like a dream. Stuff just playing out. So that's the analogy, the way to get used to thinking your dreams are dreams, so you can practice thinking life is like that and you don't grasp at it so strongly. That's the that's the idea.
And so, might I just continue the same question? So, in the realm of higher practitioners, for example,
which practitioners?
Of somebody who's acquired more beneficial karma and is more able to intercept the negative patterns of their thought, kind of.
A person who's practicing. Okay, good.
They'd be able to do that on a permanent basis, more or less, to always be in that moment of.
The more advanced you get, the more control you have over your mind in all situations, yes. And the greatest yogis can actually consciously go to what we call the dream mind. Lama Yeshe was like that. He would go to sleep every afternoon, but he didn't sleep. He had power of his mind with concentration. When he didn't lose control, he'd go to the subtle mind, which meant he ceased the grosser level, which is what happened when you go to sleep, but he was conscious. So because that mind, when you've trained, is much more powerful, he was able to use it to meditate to get realizations. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're okay? You understand?
Yeah.
Good.
Io volevo dire una cosa circa l'attaccamento. L'attaccamento.
I want to ask a question related to attachment.
Yes.
Una mia esperienza. capitato a Milano che un senza tetto mi ha chiesto se gli potevo dare una coperta.
I had this experience with a homeless person that in Milano asked me if I could give a blanket.
Oh, yeah. E gli ho portato questa, aveva una coperta grande di lana e gliel'ho portata. E la cosa incredibile è che poi sono andata via da Milano e sono passata casualmente davanti a lui dopo 2 anni e lui mi ha ringraziato dicendomi che quella coperta l'aveva tenuta benissimo, che ce l'aveva ancora, che era un regalo meraviglioso.
So my experience, I'm just sharing my experience. After 2 years I pass again near that place where I gave to this homeless person this blanket, and then he recognized me after 2 years and he thanked me again for that blanket that I gave him, and he said, I kept it very well, you know, thank you so much for this precious blanket that you gave me.
Wonderful.
Contemporaneamente lavoravo in banca e gestivo patrimoni.
At the same time I was still working in the bank, and then so I was dealing with a lot of money.
Arrivavano, in particolare questa persona che aveva miliardi, senza denti, e si lamentava in continuazione.
And then I had experience with one person that was very rich, he had billions in the bank, but he was without teeth and constantly was complaining.
That's so interesting, isn't it? There you go. Example, isn't it? It's so interesting, isn't it? So clear. This is where if we think of it karmically, when we understand these two different tracks of karma in our life, one is the tendencies in our mind, which comes from a particular lot of karmic seeds, but the other is what we get and what we have and what we receive and how people treat us. So clearly this person, we can deduce, and that maybe they were really a yogi pretending to look stupid and complaining, but let's just say they were like that. They're mean, miserly, greedy, unhappy, miserable. That's their tendency. But due to other karma from another life, incredible generosity karma. So these two don't have any relationship. Just in the same way the homeless person was sweet and grateful and humble, but had nothing. So it really shows they're two separate things. In other words, how we're seen and treated by people is one thing, but who we are is another. And this is where we get so much pain. We assume if I'm a nice person, people should be kind to me. You understand? Or we assume if a person's horrible, people should be horrible to them. It doesn't work that way. They're two separate tracks. That explains it. You know? It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. What else? Yes, Max.
So with regard to vows, I've felt mildly kind of like it's been years that I've been keeping vows, but I've never taken them. So I just wanted to double check on this. Is that like lost money and no bank?
Well, I mean, you know, okay. I mean, if you've been really seriously every day in your life thinking, I will never kill, I will never lie, that's strong, that's good. That's good, that's fantastic, it's better than not saying it at all. So it's like it's your vow, isn't it? All we're doing here is talking about the Buddha and saying these particular vows, and all the lamas would say, you know, because when you do it in front of the person, as a Buddhist, you do it in front of somebody who represents a Buddha for you, and then if you think about that, that person got it from their teacher, they got it from their teacher, and you could track that back in an unbroken chain of beings all the way back to the Buddha. So it's sort of like plugging into this power source, this lineage, you understand?
Yeah.
So of course there's some power in what you're doing, but if you know, wanted to strengthen it by taking the vows in front of a Buddhist, that could help, if you want to.
Well, with regard to that,
yes.
If I then take the vows...
If you what?
If I then take the vows...
You didn't take the vows,
no,
yeah.
No, if I continue to... Or if I take them, officially kind of take them...
Yeah.
And then break them, then
yes.
Isn't that worse karma?
Yes, but look at all the times you're keeping them. Mm-hmm. Look at the benefit. Infinite, incredible. And when you have a vow, it's hard to break a vow. You have to know it's a vow, you have to not care, you have to consciously do it and have no interest in fixing it. It's not often that we do that. We might just weaken it a little bit, you know. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth the risk. That's a bit like, I mean, that's one problem people have about vows, or what if I break them? Better not to take them. But that's like, I mean, that's again understanding the advantages of something. There's always a risk if there's an advantage to something. So let's say you think of all the advantages of driving a car. There are many, aren't there? Now, if you say, oh, but what if I have an accident? What if I don't drive properly? What if this happened? Oh, I better not. What if the police stop me? What if I go too fast? I better not drive. Then you've got to decide playing safe is more advantageous or taking the risks and seeing all the advantages of driving. It's the same thing here. When we realise the advantages, of course we'd want to do it. And when we realise the immense advantage to oneself every day, then we want that guidance. They protect us, you know. It's worth it. Do you understand?
Yeah. Mm. And taking vows, can that be with any one Buddhist?
It's a person, you know, normally in our tradition, it's a person who's been given permission by their teacher to do it, a person who's qualified. And then a person, best of course, is a person that you like and you've checked up on and you're happy to see them as a Buddha.
Okay.
Do you understand? You've got to choose the person you take them from.
Okay.
What else, people? Nothing? So what shall we do for the next 45 minutes to finish our time together, isn't it? Sing some songs. we've done all the bits and pieces of the path. We did emptiness and calm. But let's talk a bit more about concentration meditation, maybe. We didn't really do that, because the next two perfections are concentration and wisdom. We did talk about emptiness quite a bit yesterday and the day before. But here let's talk about concentration meditation, because I think there are so many misconceptions about what this technique is in the world, you know. I mean, it's the most popular thing, this mindfulness meditation now. And people can make up their own version. Buddha does not own the word mindfulness. He doesn't own the word meditation. But if we think we're doing what Buddha taught, we better know what the hell Buddha's talking about. We better be very kind of authentic. And there are many misconceptions about concentration meditation, you know. Many misconceptions about the word meditation. So, okay. One of the misconceptions about generally kind of, you know, mindfulness, broad terms, one of the misconceptions is that it's an alternative to a pill, which implies we only do it when things go wrong. We're desperate, you know. And that's a very deep assumption. In other words, you know, if I'm in love with Ron and we're having where's Ron? He's gone. Oh, there he is. He's moved closer to me. Look, he's moved closer. He's starting to trust me. Let's say Ron and I have this lovely relationship and we're all happy and blissful. You think about this, it's very true. And someone says, you know, you should learn to meditate, Rabina. I'll say, why? I'm happy. Think about that. So it really shows our assumptions are very strange. It's only when a problem comes. That's a real absurd misconception. Another misconception is because when we do it, it's only when the problems are there and we can't bear the pain. So the other misconception is it'll make all the pain go away because we're desperate. Another misconception is you meditate for all the thoughts to go away. You know, another misconception is when you do that, you're going to feel peaceful, still and calm. There's a lot of misconceptions. Another misconception is it's relaxation. Now, yoga has many brilliant relaxation techniques, and we need them because we're crazy, so we need relaxation. But single point of concentration is not an alternative to a pill. It is not to have visions. It is not to make the thoughts go away. In the long term, yes, when you have single point of concentration, you are beyond conceptual and sensory, no question. That's the long-term goal. But when we hear, oh, I'm going to meditate to make all the thoughts go away, we mean like now. That's thinking that gardening and growing an oak tree means, oh, I'm going to get an oak tree. So you put the seed in and you look out the window tomorrow morning and you're disappointed. Oh, there's no oak tree. You're kind of foolish. I remember somebody saying, I read about one woman, oh, I tried to meditate. It didn't work. I mean, we have these naive views about it, you know. Really. So it's not relaxation. I mean, in the end, when you are even some semblance of realization in single point of concentration, you'll be radiant, joyful, relaxed, blissful, no thought. You'll have all of it in abundance. But it takes time to get there. So what is it then? It's a training. You're training your mind. You're beginning the long journey of harnessing the berserk energy of this uncontrolled mind. That's what it is. It's a long-term goal. So we are so obsessed also with good feelings. And we also think of, like, even when we think of compassion, meditating on compassion, we think of meditation as a thing that you do now and it brings a result now. But it's training When you go to the gym, you don't come home and expect to be looking like, you know, Schwarzenegger overnight. You don't expect the oak tree overnight. So why expect bliss and joy overnight? It's bizarre. So this is where when people say, oh, I had a blissful meditation. We think of it in terms of an immediate experience. But it's like childish. I'm happy you had a nice feeling in your meditation, but that's not the criterion of success. Really, there's so many misconceptions, which points to, again, this thing that our attachment, we're a junkie for pleasant feelings. And whatever brings pleasant feelings, we think, oh, wow, that must be good. This is such a misconception. It really is a misconception. I mean, they say in the texts, the sign of success in this series of nine stages of concentration, at the first stage of nine stages, a sign of success is you think you're getting worse. That's going to the gym for the first time and coming home with pain you didn't know you had, muscles you didn't know you had. You know it's a sign of success. So we've got to think of it like that. It's a long-term thing. All these analogies make so much sense to us. You know, if you want to grow the oak tree, you've got to have long-term view. But you've got to start the work now. It's bizarre to expect an immediate result now. It just doesn't how it's not how it works. So always a long-term goal is this one of karma and sowing seeds, programming our mind. We get it when it comes to becoming a musician, an oak tree. We have this patience. We have a long-term view. We understand cause and effect, and we work, and we're very intelligent. But the minute it comes to getting concentration, becoming happy, becoming more compassionate, we think of it as a sort of momentary experiences. We're like very infantile. It's very strange how we think, you know. We're really obsessed with the idea that meditation is a method for getting calm and still, like as if you've got to get it then. It's a method for making the thoughts go away then. It's a method of having some kind of vision then. It's just weird. It's just not logical. It's not rational. Concentration is a long-term thing that will come, but I mean, just to expect to get it if you're just going to do 5 minutes a day, don't hold your breath. But then don't, it's okay, better than nothing. 99% of us in this room, maybe even 100%, won't go to the mountains, metaphorically or otherwise, where you need to give up sex, drugs and rock and roll with much practice under your belt in order to work for years to get single point of concentration. Most of us won't do that. It doesn't mean we can't do something, but be realistic about what you're doing. So I would put it this way. Okay, what concentration is? Let's just look at the technique. Right now, we can see that our mental consciousness is berserk. Thoughts just run automatically, and we assume this is utterly normal. We can't explain why this is this way. We don't have an explanation in neuroscience why our thoughts are uncontrolled, why people have some more negative thoughts than others. We don't know all the answers to that, I would think. I'm not sure. Not yet. Because, well, certainly from the Buddhist perspective, it's because you've come programmed into this life with those tendencies. And we can see very clearly there are some people, little girls on YouTube playing Bach. Little girl, I remember one seven-year-old girl who composes pieces of music for 60-person orchestras. I mean, you have the only explanation is she came into this life with those tendencies. Why that little man, the one serial killer I read about when he talked about when he was a tiny child, he was compelled to torture the creatures. The only way we can explain it is because he's got the tendencies. Why the fisherman? Tendencies. Why Mother Teresa? Tendencies. Why Hitler? Tendencies. At least it's an explanation. So we can see we all have got the tendency to have a fairly berserk thoughts, uncontrolled thoughts, unedited, uncontrolled thoughts. So Buddha happens, coming from these amazing Indians before him 3,000 years ago, has created this technique, has found a method to get single-pointed concentration. This process can take normally. 6 months is what Pabongka Rinpoche says a really advanced practitioner could do. But many of us, it might take 20 years, you know, based on lots of practice, lots of purification, living in vows, etc., etc., etc. So it's a long-term thing. So most of us won't do a five-minute meditation, concentration meditation session in the morning with the hope to get concentration. It needs a lot more conditions. It's like trying to become Federer by practicing once a day, you know, in the weekend tennis. You won't do it. It just won't happen. You need much more intensive commitment. It's fairly obvious. It doesn't mean you can't enjoy tennis, and it doesn't mean you can't get some skill at tennis. So what's the skill we will get from concentration meditation if we're not going to be doing it full time? Well, first, let's look at it first and what's involved. Well, what we're trying to do is concentrate. So like we talked before, you know, when we talked about emptiness, everything, every event, everything, every mind, everything is made of many pieces. So if we think of the mind, then it's made of many pieces. So here in this framework, it's going to be our concepts. So if we look into the third category of states of mind, these ones that I like to call the mechanics of the mind, you've got the different components that are going to be playing a major role in the development of concentration, one being concentration. So then the obstacles to concentration, and then there are the things we have to use to develop in our mind to get us get concentration. So the various parts of the mind that are functioning, first of all, there's intention, I will. So you sit down and you think, I will watch my breath. That has to be the first step. Then that's intention. That's followed very quickly by attention. And the one part of your mind, if you like, is attention that watches the breath. We tend to say, I'm watching my breath. I'm getting distracted. Be more precise, please. Which part of I? Your mind. Which part of your mind? I'm holding a cup. Which part of I? My hand. Which part of my hand? The thumb, the pinky. You can be precise, you know. So the mind, intention is first, and that's working every millisecond. If intention starts wandering off and wants to have a cup of tea instead, believe me, you'll get up and have your cup of tea. For sure. And then attention is the one, if you like, attention is watching the breath. But it's supported by one called mindfulness, which technically really is called not forgetfulness. It's become this major meaning, but technically it's one of these many parts of our mind that is simply the capacity to not forget what you're doing moment by moment, moment by moment. And that's obvious. Everybody needs that. As Lama Zopa says, thieves need mindfulness. We make it holy. It ain't holy. Whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need it to do your job well. Then there's another one. His Holiness calls it the policeman, called vigilance or alertness. And for some reason, some translators call it introspection. I can't see the relationship between those words, and that's the trouble with all these different translations. It's very confusing. So these are the major parts of our mind all doing their job. Now, we can't see those parts of our mind. We don't even recognize those parts of our mind. We just know, oh, I get distracted, I forget what I'm doing. We can't notice these parts. So it takes a lot of work to get these parts to do their job properly, you know. Many parts of your mind all have to work together to accomplish the staying on the breath. So what are the obstacles to this? Well, the main obstacle is called attachment. Uncontrolled thoughts is attachment, essentially, the energy of attachment, flitting from pillar to post every second, you know. So the way they frame it, the two major obstacles to getting concentration, and these are described in the nine stages as Pabongka Rinpoche, for example, in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, maps it out, you know, each stage. It's all in terms of learning to control the one obstacle, which is called excitement. It's a polite word for attachment energy, just berserk. And the other extreme is to learn to control the other extreme, which is dullness, the mind spacing out. Now, we can see this. Some of us, we sit down to meditate, we go straight to sleep. That's the extreme of dullness. Some people sit down to meditate, and some people, and this is another big misconception about meditation, some people have a capacity to sit very comfortably and to sit very nicely and feel very quiet. This actually, for most of them, is not concentration. It is not meditation. It is spacing out. And it's just gross ignorance. This is one of the major, major mistakes in interpretation, you know. And many people just love to sit and relax. Now, that's called relaxation, and I'm happy for you. But it is not concentration. Concentration is laser-like and sharp. You know, and the other people who are more like me, you just explode after 3 minutes of sitting, you know. Legs hurt, arms hurt, backs hurt, mind's berserk. Isn't it? Oh, look at those people sitting so still, you're so envious. No, they're spacing out. They're creating more ignorance for themselves. They are not concentrating. Really, this is serious, you know. So the main obstacles are the berserk. The other extreme is spacing out and then eventually sleep. So these are the two obstacles. And as you get more concentration, as you progress through the nine stages, these less excitement, less spaced out, and eventually becomes subtle excitement, subtle spacing out. Eventually becomes no excitement, no spacing out. And then you have perfected mindfulness, then you've perfected alertness, and then finally you perfect concentration. It's a long-term, gradual, incremental stages of development of these different parts of your mind. So this is why, you know, in the packaging of teachings called the three higher trainings, one way of presenting this path, the wisdom wing. The third one is to get the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Now, to get that, you've got to have the second one, which is concentration. You absolutely, Lama Yeshe says in Mahamudra, you cannot possibly realize emptiness with a gross level of mind. You have to have the single-pointedness, the laser-like focus of single-pointed concentration, shamatha. But to get that, you've got to have incredible amount of work of the practice of morality, living in vows. This is what Venerable Rene said when I interviewed him in Mandalay in 1995 about his 2.5-year retreat of concentration at Ursel Ling. He said he maybe touched upon the fifth of the nine stages in his 2.5 years. So he said there's no way in the world would he have been qualified to go to the mountains to even begin to do that retreat if he hadn't been a monk and living in vows, if he hadn't done masses of purification, if he hadn't done masses of study, and if he even hadn't done teachings. All of that was the basis of his ability to have the courage and perseverance and clarity to do the job of working on his mind so intensively for 2.5 years. So it's not just sit down and watch your breath and something happens, you know. It's like bizarre. I mean, just to do this properly, you've got to have an intimate knowledge of what the mind is. We don't have that if we don't study Buddha's law, Buddha's view. We just don't have it. We just don't have it, you know, unless we study Buddha's mind, Buddha's view of the mind. So meditation, concentration is that, is learning to focus on an object. Breath is a good start. But eventually, that's still a gross object. You need a subtle object, which would be the mind itself. So Mahamudra, the object of concentration in Mahamudra meditation, is the mind itself, which is much more tricky, but much more powerful. The very thoughts themselves. You start with simply learning to pay attention, not to the breath, but to whatever pops up in your mind. And that gets, as the mind starts becoming more calm, then the object of your concentration is the clarity of your mind. And then eventually you're able to then, you know, start moving into the second mode of meditation in Mahamudra, where you use this very particular technique to help understand the emptiness of the mind. So concentration, most of us, so if we know what we're doing, if you follow good instructions, then you can do it for 5 minutes every morning. I mean, we did an entire retreat with Lama Yeshe. I think Venerable Tashi's been doing that for you in the morning. He made us do 5-minute sessions because 99% of the time when we're sitting there even 20 minutes, it is spacing out. We're not even knowing what we're doing unless we've had proper instructions, you know. So this is where the criterion of success is not whether you feel good. The criterion of success of whether you did good gardening or not has got nothing to do with if you feel good. The success is the job you did in the ground. But we're so addicted to feelings and we think meditation is all about feelings, you know. It's really inappropriate. Remember, so many examples of people who do, due to past meditation in past lives, come into meditation. One woman who started to do Tara meditation at Chenrezig Institute and she got bliss. So she was like a little vampire. She was so greedily grasping at this bliss, like as if somehow she had realizations. Well, best to have sex. It's much more fun. You share it with somebody else. Nothing to do with virtue. She just thought it was being holy, you know. A fellow in prison, remember, he had some capacity to do deep concentration and stay there for hours with crystal clarity. He had some ability, but he didn't understand about the mind. He didn't understand about attachment. He didn't understand about ego. So he became obsessed with being a special person. He was completely obsessed. He wrote to Lama Zopa, and Rinpoche just ignored. He said, forget about realizations. Your job is to help sentient beings do 4 million prostrations, you know. Couldn't even hear it. I remember one fellow, a Brazilian, in Tuxita, in Dharamsala years ago, would come into class exhausted every morning because overnight he'd spent running around going to Africa to see this and going to his girlfriend's room in Melbourne. He had the ability, you know, your experience, he had the ability every day to do that because he had obviously some merit from past lives, from meditation, that he had clairvoyance and he could access it during his sleep. He didn't leave his body, but the mind has the experience of being there. That's what the mind can do. He did it every day, and he was addicted to it. And he was bored by the boring teachings of attachment and anger and giving up all the dramas and disciplining his body. He thought he was a Buddha. He thought he was holy, you know. But it would make him crazy one day. He didn't know what was going on because he hasn't understood about how the mind works, what delusions are, what virtues are. There's so many misconceptions, really. So then if we're not going to be the serious meditators up in the mountains giving up sex, drugs and rock and roll, then what's the benefit if we do that simple kind of meditation? Okay, we know as Tibetan Buddhists we have all these other kinds. We've got faith in our lamas, we've got these deity practices, we visualize the Buddha. That's a different discussion. They're very potent in themselves. There's so much blessing from those practices because we're utilizing the Buddha, even if we don't have concentration. There's enormous blessing for most of us. But watching your breath, this is an interesting point too. Watching your breath with your legs crossed and your eyes closed, in its nature, has got nothing to do with a virtuous practice. It is not spiritual practice. What makes that spiritual is your motivation. So it's just a samsaric action. It's nothing holy. We have that massive misconception too. As soon as you see a person crossing their legs, we think they're being holy. I mean, how bizarre can you get? So what's the benefit to us? Or even doing a 5-minute concentration meditation for the day. What's the benefit? It's clear. What you're doing for that 5 minutes, doing the best you can to stay focused on your breath, let's say. And this is the point now too. Okay, if you're doing your 5 minutes watching the breath and you're training, one of the first things to think of is you're stepping out of your head. That's a really good way to put it. Because normally in daily life we wake up, don't we? Then we go to sleep. Throughout that period, we're 99% engaged, involved, absorbed in the outside. We know that. And we wouldn't be able to account on a normal day when nothing dramatic happens. We probably couldn't account for 99.9% of the thoughts we had. You with me? We're so busy with the jobs and the kids and the traffic and the this. And that's fine. That's our life. But when there's utterly no awareness of what's happening in the mind until it becomes emotional, then we notice. Because we can't help but notice. So what we're doing in the morning is, if you like, consciously stepping out and becoming more objective, consciously stepping out of your head, and you're training yourself just to watch the breath. Attention, I'm going to pay attention to the breath. So you know, because your mind's not trained yet, that within a second it'll wander off. So what you have to do is, because your mindfulness is scattered, so what you have to do is you bring the mind back to the breath. Then it wanders off again, and you bring the mind back to the breath. That's the job of mindfulness and alertness. That's their job. They're watching, like a policeman, alertness, His Holiness says. So you have to be aware that you're wandering off the breath. One of the serious ones of distraction, spacing out, is that you're watching your breath and then 10 minutes later you notice you've just spaced out, but you've been wandering off for 10 minutes. That's serious distraction. Do you understand? That's serious distraction. That's like, you know, the job, and that's where we get all, again, confused about the purpose of meditation is to have a nice feeling. Let's say you're spacing out and you have a nice feeling. You think you've got a good meditation. Well, that's like you're learning to ride a bike. And the job of riding a bike is to stay on the bike, please. That's it. But let's say you fall off and you look at the sky. Oh, the sky's lovely. And you sit there for 20 minutes. That's not the job. The job is to ride the bike. Get back on again, please. You can enjoy the sky later. The job is to get concentration, not to space out. The job is not to feel good. The job isn't to relax, it's to train your mind to stay on the breath. God, are we communicating? So, what's the benefit for us who won't get much concentration? Well, you're stepping out of your head for that 5 minutes. So what you're doing is focusing on the breath. But you can't help but notice all the crazy thoughts, right? That's fine. Don't think that's not good. Don't think, oh, I had a bad meditation, all my thoughts were there. Well, of course they're there. But you're training to stay on the breath. So what's happening by training to stay on the breath, the attention, because you've been conscious. You're conscious. You're consciously bringing yourself back. You're consciously bringing, so it's you've been conscious. You're making decisions, not just spacing out and being absorbing. We're normally absorbed like this, you know. There's no awareness. So here you're training. It's quite hard work to train. So, even for 5 minutes you do that, you can say what you're learning to do is start to become conscious, even though you're watching the breath, because you're anchoring your mind to the breath. That's just anchor, really. Not because the breath is special, but because you can't help but notice the thoughts now. You can't help but notice the thoughts now. That's why when you're trying to go to sleep at night and it's dark and there's nothing else to be involved in, you are hearing these thoughts like you can't believe. They've always been this way. But because you're not distracted by any sensory things anymore, all you can do is hear the shouting. Do you understand? That's always there. So suddenly, when you start to watch your breath, you're paying attention. That's why you think you're getting worse. You're not. You just not noticed before. So this is good, good, good. And why is it good, good, good? Because these are the ones you want to start to sort with. So when, as soon as you come out of your meditation and you start open your eyes and do the breakfast and deal with the kids and deal with the hubby and the traffic, now you're slowly learning to notice your thoughts. That's the job in daily life. That's our job in daily life, to start to become conscious, not just of the traffic, not just what the husband's doing, not just what the kids are doing, but you've learned this new skill to now also be conscious of the thoughts. That's the skill we have to learn. And then we have to learn to navigate all those thoughts. And this is enormously difficult because it's so, we normally don't notice the thoughts until they're full-blown emotions and the body's shaking. That's our big tragedy. And that's why we have so much serious problems, because we wait until the wheels fall off before we start working on our mind. But our mind's working all the time. Like in my relationship with Ron, I think, why would I meditate? I'm happy. Attachment's berserk. All my delusions are there because I feel good. I don't think I need to work on anything. Completely wrong. So don't wait till you're... Ron leaves you. Don't wait till you're sent to prison and accused of murder. Don't wait till the bad things happen before you start working on your mind. Work with the baby things every day, and then it's easy to fix the problem. If Ron just annoys you with a burp, that's easier to handle in your mind than when he leaves you. So don't wait till he leaves you. Work with the mind. Notice the attachment. Notice the anger. Notice the jealousy. Notice the depression. Of course, there's a flood of emotions in there. It's hard to distinguish all the thoughts, but that's the job we have to learn to do. We get more and more precise in our ability to discriminate between this thought and that thought. It really is hard, but that's the job. And the more we can be aware of what's going on, and the better we can start to learn that. But this is where we have to shift the assumption that somehow having all these thoughts is bad. Of course it's bad. Join the universe. But that's who we are now, and we've got to deal with it. Pull up your sleeves and start working with it. So the major shift that has to happen, and this is really hard. I mean, I hear people who've been saying, I've been practicing for 30 years. I still get angry. I'm so depressed about it. Wrong view, people. It's so distressing. Of course there's anger there. Of course there's attachment. To not have anger and attachment, you're a highly realised being. So we're going to have to, so in other words, until, you know, it's sort of like every day you go out to your garden, you put the acorn in and you nourish it with a bit of water. And every time you go out, all you do is notice all the things. All you do is notice that there's no oak tree. All you do is notice all the weeds around. All you do is say, oh, where's my oak tree? I'm still miserable. My oak tree hasn't come yet. You've got to be more patient. You've got to be more patient. And that means we've got to learn to live with the rubbish old garden before the oak tree starts popping up, or even before the little roses start popping. You've got to learn to live with what's there, but nourishing the seeds every day. And be happy that you've nourished the seeds. Be happy you're sowing the seeds. It's long term. So then the crucial attitude to develop is the more you see your thoughts, the more, yes, you recognize there's fear, there's jealousy, there's guilt, there's anger, and the more you feel the emotional component, but you're grabbing it before it becomes emotional, you get it when it's more thoughts quietly underneath, then you can use your virtuous thoughts to argue with them. You're becoming your own friend. You hear your rubbish thoughts, and it was just a mild one like the burp, and I feel myself getting annoyed. I hear my thought, oh, you know, it's burping again. Shut up, Rabina. Give it a break. Your attachment's not getting what it wants. That's your problem. Let him burp. Right there, you deal with it and you solve the problem. Honestly, that's how you work on your mind. Don't wait for him to kill you before you start working on your mind. So you learn, you navigate the little problems, and you learn to distinguish the rubbish from the goodness. It's not easy. And then also you cultivate the good thoughts. You know, I've never heard yet a person say, oh, you know, my mind is so busy with good thoughts all the time, I can't stop them. We've got to cultivate good thoughts. We've got to they're all there. It's like I think of all of them as my roommates, okay? And usually for all of us, the negative roommates make a big noise. They're like running the house, isn't it? So, of course, we believe they're bigger than everything else. And then we keep buying into them and then get stressed about them. So bad enough you've got anger and jealousy roommates, you then add another roommate because you get angry with jealousy and anger. And so we keep adding new bad roommates because we're angry with anger, and we're angry with jealousy, and we're angry about depression, we're dissatisfied, so we keep piling on all the negative roommates. So we've got to bring in the positive roommates. They're hiding under the bed in the wardrobe, you know. Bring them out. I'm doing a good job. It's okay. That's just anger, Rabina. You'll handle it, honey. It's okay. It doesn't define you. It's not who you really are. Relax. Or sometimes just shut up, you know, to the bad roommates. And slowly, if you keep bringing the good thoughts out, cultivating good thoughts, cultivating positive thoughts, they start to have a bit of a voice now. And you start to hear the good roommates as well as the rubbish ones. And before you know it, when you start to practice, they'll start having a bigger voice. So it's hard internal work, but we've got to be aware of it and consciously involved in it. We've got to be not just accept what's there passively, you know. Are we communicating? So concentration is just simply concentration. The rest of it really, this is the next, this other proactive approach of even walking around living your daily life. Technically, that's insight meditation, but not on your cushion. And you're using analysis, aren't you? The proactive use of analysis and observation of what's happening, and you're working with yourself, telling yourself, shut up, work with this one, deal with that one. That's the insight. That's the analytical approach, which is the second mode, but not done formally. You're doing it informally throughout the day. You don't have to sit on your cushion to do analysis. That's bizarre. Your thoughts work in all the time. Do your analysis while you're walking, on the toilet, driving the car. Of course you can. But it's not formal closing your eyes meditation, but it's that activity. It's called thinking it through, solving the problems. Of course you can do that with emptiness and everything else as well. But you will do it really well, obviously, when you've got really good concentration. So don't mystify these two modes of meditation, please. But concentration is learning to train your mind to stay on one thing. It's training. It's training. But the immediate benefit, as I said, is because you're training yourself, you can't help but hear your thoughts, but you're not being distracted by them. We learn that in daily life, and that's the skill we have to bring to daily life. But concentration is concentration is concentration. And then the benefits of it in your daily life, you can see, you know. So are we communicating or not? I hope we are. But the technique itself, as I said, you should, you know, just read through from a book. It's very helpful to hear the gradually this, then that, then this, you know. And learn to know these different parts of your mind. Alertness, intention, attention, concentration, discrimination. They all have to do their bit, their job in helping you get, finally, perfecting concentration. Then you don't need to use mindfulness anymore. You don't need to use any effort anymore. You don't need to use alertness anymore. You no longer have distraction. You no longer have excitement. You've solved the problem. You've now got single-pointed, effortless concentration. Effortless. And when you've got it, you can go there effortlessly anytime you like. And now you're ready to use this laser-like focus in the second mode in a classical meditation where you will now do the insight meditation. But here you're going to use the laser-like focused mind to do subtle analysis of dependent arising, for example, that will then trigger the insight. Ah, I see. There's no inherent I. That's the two at the end of the six perfections. But insight meditation can be used to get insight into karma, insight into impermanence, insight into your problems, insight into everything in Buddha's path. It's not just, you know, you've got to get insight into everything. So the insight method is using thinking. The concentration method is training your mind to focus. And you use them together in one session. But we can use the same thing in our daily life. You get some focus in the morning and you get more and more aware of what's happening in your mind while you're doing the dishes, while you're driving the car. And then you're doing your analysis of the problem as you're having it, not just waiting until you want to kill somebody. That's daily practice. You're working on your mind as you go every day. So if you do that every day, then by the end of the day, you've managed your little drama problems. You've managed them. You've sorted them out. You've argued with them. You've come to a conclusion. You let go of the anger. You let go of the hurt. But if you don't ever look at the hurt, don't ever look at the anger, don't ever look at the depression, it builds up until it's unbearable. And that's when we have to go to a therapist or kill the husband or yourself. And that's when the wheels are falling off at 180 kilometres an hour on the autostrada. It's a bit late to notice, oh, my wheels are falling off, what'll I do? Bit late. So you don't wait to go to the mechanic for your wheels to fall off. You deal with the little wobbles first. That's why even when you're happy, there's masses of attachment, so there's plenty to look at. Learn to know your mind right there. then we'll manage life. Then we will manage life beautifully because we're conscious and aware of our thoughts. But this is where it's not easy. We can be great scholars in the Dharma, you know, working at the master's program, knowing all the answers, being a good teacher, still not seeing so much of our mind, not able to own it, you know. It's very painful, very hard job to do. So we need lots of purification. Keep our vows purely, keep our samaya purely. This is the secret to success, you know. We can go to lunch and finish our course now. Oh. Max, come on. So let's finish. Yeah? What do we do to finish? What do we do to finish? Do you have anything to do? Yeah, we do on that? Okay. Let's do it then. You sing the prayers then. Tell the people where the prayers are. So we finish. We just, okay, let's just think. Let's first think. Here we've been for, I don't know how long, 6 weeks, 2 years, 5 days, I don't know, whatever. Thinking how marvelous all these thoughts we've had, all these seeds we've planted, none of it goes astray. So let's nourish these seeds. Let's nourish all this work we've done. That's what's important. From this time forward, two things, by using our body and speech to be of benefit to others, at least don't harm them, and other one, your mind. So they say, when you're with others, control your behavior. When you're with yourself, control your mind. If we can. And we can do both even better. So think too, by using the day well, when you with your body and speech, like I said before, if you try to act like the bodhisattvas, attempt to think that you're there for others and behave nicely. And when you're on your own, that's when you can do the work internally. So right now, we can see right now, because we haven't practiced much and we're not aware of our thoughts and we're not able to hold our emotions, then when we see a friend and she says, how are you, Rabina? Just everything pours out, doesn't it? It just pours out because we need support, which is understandable. But if we're never aware of our mind, that's all we ever do. So we just vomit everything out to whoever's going to hear us with no self-respect whatsoever. But if we're really working on our mind, you know, I mightn't have seen Siliana for 10 years, let's say, and my husband left me yesterday. Oh, Rabina, I'd love to see you. How are you? And I'm really well, Siliana. How are you, sweetheart? She would never need to know, and she wouldn't even need to know by looking at me because you're working with your mind. That's how good we can become, working with your mind. And what you do to others is present what's best for them. This is profound, I tell you. So we try to do that. But let's just finish, too, with the four immeasurable thoughts, these marvelous, compassionate thoughts, okay, the brave attitude of the bodhisattva. So just think, very casually, you know, in the hearts, thinking it sincerely. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could abide in equanimity, free of attachment, ignorance, and anger. May they abide so. And now the brave attitude of the bodhisattva, I will make this happen. Please, Guru Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it will be all sentient beings could be free of suffering and its causes. May they be free. I will make this happen. Please, Guru Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it will be all sentient beings could have happiness and its causes. May they have them. I will make this happen. Please, Guru Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it will be if all sentient beings were never parted from higher rebirths and liberations, excellent bliss. May they never be parted. I will make this happen. Please, Guru Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. So the other one is just to never give up, really. We never give up. No, it's logical. We can do it. We have examples right in front of us who show that it's possible. So to have that encouragement, that enthusiasm, it's possible, I can do it. It's possible, I can do it. One step at a time. One step at a time. One step at a time. It's very profound. And never give up on ourselves. That's it. So let's do our prayers. What page, Simeona? The dedication. Just gave our D and Junction. You don't know? Pages? Somebody? And then do the mandala first. We do the mandala and we dedicate, right? Mandala first? Mandala first. Yeah? We do. So we're just waiting to let people get their prayer book. Tell the page. We're going to offer a mandala first, which is offering all the contents of the universe to the Buddha as if the Buddha is he himself, as a gratitude, as gratitude for the teachings. It's very auspicious to do that. Mandalakam Niyatayami. And let's say those couple of prayers for the long life of His Holiness and Lamas Open, all our holy lamas, okay? Where's the His Holiness one? Somewhere here. Can we say that one? The one the room says written. It's gone from here. I had it. Oh, thank you. Got that? You got it? The wish granting. Go on. Okay, I'll say it. It's just a piece of paper. I'll say it, you translate. The wish. This is Rinpoche said, because the other prayer, the long life prayer, is always saying about the snow land of Tibet. But as Rinpoche says, he's the whole world, you know. So Rinpoche says another little prayer. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. So we think of Lama Zabba Rinpoche, and we think of all the Geshe's here, your lamas, your own teachers, all of our own teachers. We think, may all they live long. May they live long. You know, we need them. We need them badly. We need these heavy with qualities, examples for us, to show us how to become that. May they live long, and may we live long. That's all. And then now we can do the two little prayers, 101, yeah? Dedication. Say it in Italian, it's good. Say it in Italian. You said 101. I thought you said 101. Yeah, there's not gay body. Gay body. Not there. Not there. I was going to do it in Tibetan. I was saying it in Tibetan. Go on. I mean, I meant to do it in English and in Tibetan. But I'm sorry. Say it in Tibetan. Go, Chashi. Go, Chashi.
In your Lama Sangye Drogyurne Drowa Chikyang Mahalupa
So may all these seeds be planted, may we nourish them so we become a Buddha, so we can be of benefit to sentient beings. That's what we said then. So now may bodhicitta that has grown grow more, and may which hasn't grown, may it develop. Jangchub Semchub.
Semchog Rinpoche Make Panam Kegyochig Kepa Nyampa Mepayang Gong Ne Gong Du Pervashog.
Okie doke. Thank you, Siliana.
Thank you.
Precious one.
Photo group.
Let's do it, yes.
Together.
Yes, yes. Okay, come on. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Very good.
God, I'm so glad. Good. Thank you, yes.